Welcome back to the program. My name is Scott. Today, we open a door to an incredible triumphant story of faith and the redemptive power of Jesus Christ. Our guest is J.M., whose journey is a testament to how God can turn the darkest detours into a divine destination. J.M., born and raised in Queens, New York, first encountered the Holy Bible as a historical text in a college course and was quickly captivated. Through the prayers of loved ones, he accepted Christ's gift of salvation around Easter 2011. God led him on a years-long journey of growth and discipleship, which included attending a strict discipleship home in Illinois in 2013 and a Baptist Bible college in California. By 2017, J.M. moved back to Queens. His heart turned away from Christ, focusing more on political and cultural battles. He traveled the country for political work, but eventually found himself in a dark and bitter mental state. At the onset of the 2020 pandemic, his life took a seismic turn. J.M. was entrapped into committing a crime and sent to prison. However, here is where the story takes a turn toward the true light. While incarcerated, the Lord sustained him and his then-girlfriend. Their faith held them together until his release in the fall of 2023. They married in 2024 and now have a beautiful baby daughter. J.M. is now ready to share his powerful story of redemption through his work with CA Jail Outreach. Today, we'll discuss how God found J.M., how he struggled in the secular world, and what it truly means to hold down the fortress of love and faith when you are behind bars. We have a saying, we don't say goodbye, we say, until the trumpet blows. Let's push forward until he comes. God bless you. Please welcome J.M., also known as a voice from the inside. This is his story brought to you by Steve and Trinity from the CA Jail Podcast digital team.
Thank you, Scott, for that excellent introduction. We're absolutely thrilled that you're part of the CA Jail Outreach digital community team. We're beginning a deep dive today into a topic that, well, it requires intense vulnerability, and it's based on a remarkably powerful firsthand account.
Welcome, everyone, to Growth Journey, a deep dive podcast. Our deep dive today is entirely built upon a really profound memoir. It's written by someone identified as a voice from the inside, an individual who actually spent significant time in federal prison.
Right. And for you, the listener, we just want to clarify the purpose behind this format, why we're doing it this way. You see, by presenting this deep dive as a podcast, well, it allows the author more time.
Exactly. It frees him up to dedicate that time to other vital initiatives within the community, you know, sharing his story, his life, really, to help others maintain their relationships intact while they navigate the correctional system.
Mm-hmm. This memoir is essentially his roadmap, isn't it? For endurance and hopefully reunion.
That's a great way to put it. Our mission here is to get a clear, unvarnished perspective on the soul-stretching pain, as he calls it, and the practical hardships, too, the stuff that comes with incarceration for both the person inside and the loving partner waiting on the outside.
Yeah, and we're focusing specifically on how a couple overcomes that huge challenge of time and distance. The big question really is, how can a relationship survive, maybe even thrive, when it's stripped down to its absolute barest essentials?
It's a tough question.
Okay, let's unpack this. We're dealing with really high stakes here and some unique terminology the author uses. Things like soul-stretching pain and referencing the strict Spartan nature of a prison relationship.
Mm.
Right. That right there signals this isn't your typical long-distance situation.
Yeah.
Not at all. So the memoir kicks off with this intensely clear premise. Incarceration is a living nightmare, a truly devastating consequence of poor decisions. That's how he frames it. But for the couple who is committed to staying together, it forces this serious, often brutal kind of commitment, compounded by just immense difficulty. We really need to dig into what the author means when he calls this a Spartan relationship. What does that look like?
Well, what's fascinating, I think, is the analogy itself. It's very precise, historically and functionally, yeah, to the ancient Spartans. You know, they valued discipline, resilience, minimalism, focusing only on the essential. And a relationship inside the correctional system is similarly stripped down. Or maybe you could say surgically reduced to its absolute core functional components. It's not just a metaphor he's using. It's a detailed accounting of what the system allows and, crucially, what it forbids.
Okay, so for listeners who've maybe only experienced standard relationships, what are those minimal components, the things that have to sustain the connection under this system using the memoir.
He details three main things. All the richness we normally associate with a shared life, like shared meals, just being physically present, spontaneous interactions, all that is gone. It's replaced by three tightly controlled methods. First, you have the essential emotional connection maintained through physical love letters, actual paper letters. Second, the voice connection that's limited to a once daily 15-minute phone call. Just 15 minutes.
Wow. Daily, but only 15 minutes.
Exactly. And third, during the rare monitored visits, the physical connection is reduced to minimal contact. We're talking a hug and a kiss, often just at the start and end of the visit. And that's it. That's the entire sort of nutritional content for the relationship. And it has to sustain them, sometimes for years.
And even that minimal contact, the physical and the time, it just highlights the extreme vulnerability, doesn't it, being in that environment. The author points out that even this lifeline, these small things, they can be instantly removed.
Instantly, yeah.
We saw that devastatingly during the COVID-19 pandemic. The Bureau of Prisons completely suspended visitation.
Yeah.
It just reinforces how fragile that bond is when it's entirely dependent on institutional approval.
Exactly right. And the outside partner is, effectively, as the author puts it, holding down the fortress of love, often completely alone. When the memoir looks for a comparison in society, it compares this psychological duress to military separation.
Oh, okay.
That sense of longing and psychological duress that a spouse might feel waiting for a loved one deployed overseas.
I appreciate that comparison. It gives a frame of reference. But the author immediately follows up with a crucial, really heartbreaking difference. We need to spend a moment on this.
Yeah.
While the psychological separation might feel similar, this path carries none of the honor nor benefits that come with overseas military service.
That distinction is absolutely paramount. You hit the nail on the head. Military service brings a certain honor, cultural recognition, often governmental support, a clear sense of purpose or mission, usually.
Right. There's a framework around it.
Yes. Incarceration, on the other hand, brings social stigma, shame, judgment, crushing financial hardship. And all of that comes without any accompanying safety net. So the person on the outside isn't just enduring separation. They're enduring separation plus social condemnation. That weight, the shame tied to the conviction, makes the duress doubly hard, much harder.
And let's clarify one of the communication methods the author mentioned, truancy his emails. When you say this relationship is Spartan, how does that specific technology reinforce the constraint?
Good question. Truancy, OCSSAFS for anyone unfamiliar, stands for Trust Fund Limited Inmate Communication System. And it is not like sending a normal email, not at all. It's heavily monitored, it's subject to delay, and critically, it's paper use.
Ah, paper use.
Yes. Every single message costs money, either for the inmate or the partner outside, so it's not this instantaneous free flow of thoughts you might have with regular email or texting. It's a tightly regulated, costly, and non-private exchange. It forces communication to be very careful, curated, often quite terse. It absolutely reinforces that Spartan nature.
Okay. Despite all these constraints, these really harsh limitations, the memoir introduces something counterintuitive. He calls it a unique phenomenon. If love and faith are somehow maintained, the relationship can actually grow richer as the sentence matures, culminating, potentially, in a most glorious reunion.
How can distance, which statistically seems to destroy most relationships in this context, actually make the heart grow fonder here? It really speaks to that that intensive purification process you mentioned earlier, maybe. The separation basically eliminates all the superficial elements of the relationship. Shared consumption, convenience, casual intimacy, domestic comforts, all gone. So all that's left is the absolute essence. Commitment, emotional support, shared goals. If those foundational elements are truly sound, the relationship gets refined by the pressure, not eroded.
So it becomes a test of pure intentionality. It really forces the issue.
Yeah.
The analysis point seems clear then. This growth isn't automatic. It's not a passive thing. The separation itself doesn't magically strengthen the bond. It's the deliberate, often agonizing effort.
That's it, the effort.
The effort of communication, support, shared spiritual focus. That's what does it.
Precisely. It's an active choice every single day to use those 15 minutes well, or to write that letter. And not just to complain about the hardship, which would be understandable, but to actually build something positive. The author's testimony is so powerful because he lived this. He was one of the fortunate souls, as he says, who experienced this growth over nearly 3.5 years. He talks about the glorious edifice of undeniable love they built together.
An edifice. That's such a strong image, a grand building. It suggests structure, planning, resilience. And this edifice It wasn't built with, you know, shared vacations or expensive gifts. It was built stone by stone, using only those limited resources available. The precious letters, those monitored Trulance SE emails, and every single visit. It implies that every interaction had to be structural. It had to carry profound weight.
Yes, every touch point mattered immensely.
It had to be a moment of planning, or affirmation, or shared vision, not just shooting the breeze.
No room for small talk, really. It all had to count. But now we have to pivot. We have to move from that qualitative experience, that possibility of growth, to the cold quantitative reality. The memoir forces us, and you the listener, to confront what it calls the hard truth. It really underscores the statistical war that these couples are fighting, maintaining commitment under these circumstances. It's a victory against overwhelming systemic odds.
Yeah, we really can't rush past these numbers. They explain the stakes involved. They're stark. Let's start with the statistics for men, straight from the memoir. They're devastating.
They really are. For men, the failure rate is just staggering. It's estimated that 80%. 80% of marriages for incarcerated men break up between their arrest and the end of the first year in prison.
80% in the first year, between arrest and the end of year one.
Yes. Think about the gravity of that. 4 out of every 5 couples cannot withstand that initial shock. The economic collapse, the legal battle that happens before and right after sentencing. The marriage often dies before the prison sentence truly even begins.
That's gut-wrenching. And that devastating statistic is followed by one that's even more sobering regarding women. For female inmates, the divorce rate is reported to be closer to 100%. 100.
It's almost total, and this really highlights the immense gender differences in societal and, frankly, economic expectations. When the man is removed from the household, society often expects the woman to hold the family together somehow.
Right. That's the expectation, fair or not.
But when the woman is removed, the support structure often just disintegrates. It's compounded by historical expectations, you know, women as primary caregivers, nurturers, plus the loss of her income if she was working, and just her presence is often seen as unbearable by the partner left on the outside.
And time itself becomes the enemy here. The length of the sentence acts like a relentless ticking clock. The memoir notes that each year of incarceration increases the odds that an inmate's marriage will end in dissolution either before or after release by an average of 32%.
32% per year. It's not a slow, steady decline. It's an exponential compounding of risk. Every year makes it significantly harder.
Wow.
And that 32% yearly increase, it connects directly to the 4 primary sources of strain the author identifies. Incarceration basically introduces these destructive forces right into the relationship dynamic itself. The memoir points to less marital love, obviously. More relationship violence, and that can manifest as financial control, emotional manipulation, psychological distress exerted from the inside.
Not necessarily physical violence, then.
Not always, no. It's often more insidious. Then more economic strain, which is huge, and significantly greater odds of extramarital sex.
So while incarceration is the root cause, the analysis shows these secondary effects, the strain, the lack of love, the infidelity risk, these are often the things that actually kill the relationship. Those 4 strains listed, they explain roughly 40% of why these marriages dissolve. The prison system sets the stage, but it's the financial stress and the emotional collapse that often deliver the final blow.
Absolutely. And the weight of managing those secondary effects, it falls almost entirely on the outside partner. The memoir is very explicit in detailing the crushing hardship faced by the spouse who's waiting. It's not just financial insecurity from lost income, which is bad enough. It's the sole unrelenting burden of parenting, household management, all the economic responsibilities.
Let's really unpack the financial cost for a second, because this feels like where the system imposes one of its cruelest burdens. The memoir notes that just maintaining contact, those required calls, the emails, the visits, it's expensive.
Extremely expensive. We're talking about high costs for the Bureau of Prisons phone systems, which charge exorbitant rates for those short 15-minute calls. There are fees for services like JPay or Trulin NES for the emails. And then there's the substantial expense and time commitment for travel and maybe lodging just to make visits happen. Prisons are often located hundreds of miles away.
So it creates this debilitating cycle, doesn't it? The outside partner loses a salary or a significant portion of income, yet she's actively spending money, maybe going into debt or draining savings.
Exactly. Just to keep those basic lines of communication open, the emotional and structural lines, she's essentially paying a high premium for a significantly reduced quality relationship. It's like an economic tribute just to maintain hope.
This immense financial and emotional pressure, it leads to that intensely difficult pragmatic compromise the memoir describes regarding intimacy. The man is inside, obviously without physical intimacy. Yet the author notes some men pragmatically accept the potential of their wives cheating, provided they just wait for them. Just be there when they get out.
This is a moment of just profound psychological devastation described in the memoir. It observes with chilling accuracy that this acceptance costs him his dignity. It's the moment the incarcerated man feels forced to sacrifice a core expectation of marriage fidelity, not because he wants to, but out of sheer desperation, the fear of total abandonment.
Wow.
He gives up his dignity, hoping to preserve the commitment itself. It highlights the profound emotional subjugation that the system enforces. It really speaks volumes about the vulnerability and the despair felt by the person inside.
Okay, so given these destructive forces we've just laid out, the 80% failure rate, that compounding 32% annual risk, the economic drain, the potential loss of dignity, the memoir pivots. It argues that a powerful external counter-strategy is absolutely required for victory. And that brings us to the section titled, Building a Foundation on the Rock.
Indeed. And the author frames this not as, you know, optional advice or a nice suggestion. It's presented as the essential requirement for victory. Using that biblical metaphor, the wise man building his house upon the rock to weather any storm. The memoir stresses that for a relationship enduring incarceration, nothing less will suffice. The implication is that this challenge is so uniquely severe that a purely secular or material foundation, it will inevitably crumble under the strain of time and distance. It just won't hold up.
The core belief articulated here is that if a couple is truly devoted first to God and then to each other, victory is possible. Regardless of how severe the storm gets, there's this deep conviction that God is greater than the bounds of time and space that includes sentences and prison walls.
And this is the revolutionary shift in perspective.
Yeah.
This is what potentially allows the relationship to survive those grim statistics we just talked about. If your anchor is spiritual, it exists outside the prison's jurisdiction.
Right. Ah, that's a powerful way to think about it.
It's impervious to the BOP's rules. It's unaffected by the cost of phone calls. It's immune to the shame imposed by society. It provides a shared, untouchable reality for the couple, something the system can't take away.
To make this foundation concrete, the memoir provides two specific scriptures, King James Version scriptures. They act almost like the structural blueprint for building that unshakable foundation.
Right. The first scripture establishes the primary mandate, ensuring that the commitment to God actually precedes and empowers the commitment to the partner. This is Luke chapter 10, verse 27. It mandates, "Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart and with all thy soul and with all thy strength and with all thy mind and thy neighbor as thyself." So, the incarcerated individual needs to first secure his own identity and worth in his faith before he can reliably commit to the incredibly arduous task of sustaining his relationship through all that hardship.
Okay, so that's the individual anchor first. And the second passage, it directly addresses the power of the partnership itself, recognizing the strength that's gained when two people are unified under that higher commitment.
Exactly. That's Ecclesiastes chapter 4, verse 12. It states, "And if one prevail against him, two shall withstand him, and a threefold cord is not quickly broken." And the analysis of that threefold cord is really key to the memoir's whole thesis. It's not just the two spouses desperately clinging to each other, which, as the 80% failure rate shows, is often tragically insufficient.
Right. Two strands might not be enough here.
Precisely. It's the inclusion of the third strand, God, which provides that non-breaking strength, the strength needed to absorb the systemic shocks of incarceration.
All right. So with that spiritual bedrock established as essential, the memoir then offers some intensely actionable, very practical guidance, and it focuses primarily on the partner on the outside, the one waiting. This is really where the rubber meets the road, isn't it? And the author promises that the hard work, the patience, it will not be rendered in vain.
Yes, and he powerfully re-emphasizes that building metaphor we talked about earlier,
right,
reminding the waiting partner of her profound role in this. Every phone call, every letter, every single visit is a stone placed one upon another, reaching ultimately up into a glorious edifice of our love. It reframes what might feel like a daily grind into a vital architectural effort. Each action builds something lasting.
I like that. The first crucial block of advice focuses on self-preservation, really, and stability at home. The waiting partner must prioritize herself and the family unit first so she's capable of sustaining the man inside. And this requires very practical, grounded actions, especially when facing chaos.
Yes. The list provided is quite comprehensive. First, immediately taking charge of the finances and the budget. This often means learning complex financial management skills pretty much overnight. Securing power of attorney, maybe restructuring debts, figuring out how to manage all the household expenses on a dramatically reduced income. If the home front collapses financially, the relationship's chances just plummet.
Makes sense. Beyond the financial, there's the emotional and familial responsibility. She has to keep the children healthy and, critically, make sure they remain connected to their father. She becomes the primary emotional bridge. And recognizing the deep isolation she faces, the memoir suggests seeking out support groups. It specifically mentions prisoners' wives, girlfriends and partners, or PWGP.
That support structure is absolutely essential because the waiting partner is dealing with this unique form of social stigma and loneliness. The isolation can be profound. Her husband is gone, but she isn't really single. She often bears the stigma of his prime, and she has to navigate this complex, often inhumane institutional bureaucracy, usually all alone. Connecting with groups like PWGP helps mitigate that emotional fatigue. It provides practical advice from others who've successfully navigated the system. It's invaluable.
Okay, so moving from self-care to directly nurturing the relationship itself, the memoir stresses that the waiting partner is the key. The key to keeping communication open and ensuring the inmate remains connected to the family, they really are carrying the torch of hope.
Intentionality is paramount here. Absolutely paramount. They have to utilize those costly, limited methods, the letters, the emails, the visits consistently. We know from research, not just this memoir, that increased family contact is repeatedly identified as pivotal to maintaining ties. When the man inside loses his connection to the outside world, despair can really set in. And the likelihood of success, both during the sentence and upon release, it just decreases dramatically.
Now let's talk about the quality of that interaction.
Yeah.
Because that's perhaps even more important than frequency when time is so incredibly limited. The author advises communicating desires and needs openly, using this time to strengthen communication skills.
Right. This is seen as a protective factor against the relationship dissolving. If a couple can learn to speak honestly, openly, directly under the rigid constraints of a 15-minute monitored phone call, well, they'll likely have profoundly robust communication skills when they're finally reunited. This time, as difficult as it is, should be used to sort of rehearse a healthy, functional relationship for the future, not just constantly reporting on the daily traumas of the present.
That's a great point. And there's a crucial emotional tip given specifically for the outside partner. Try to avoid dwelling on the incarceration itself during interactions. Instead, the focus should be on maybe fun, lighter topics, like sports, movies, or their shared religious faith.
This is vital, truly vital for the survival of the man inside. He is already completely immersed in the darkness and negativity of the system 24/7. The spouse on the outside needs to be the source of light. The connection to a future outside those walls. By focusing on shared interests, positive things, their faith, she ensures the relationship remains a beacon of hope and affirmation, rather than just becoming another constant reminder of the painful separation.
And finally, that foundation of faith comes back to the forefront. The advice is to maintain faith together, using this challenging time to grow from the inside out, as the author puts it.
Yes, this involves active participation. Things like discussing the Bible together over the phone, maybe reading the same passages separately and talking about them, praying together during calls. It ensures there's a spiritual synergy, so they're hopefully growing in the same direction despite the physical distance. And the memoir offers this really powerful final perspective that kind of encapsulates the whole path to victory.
Ultimately, the societal labels, you know, convicted felon, criminal, ne'er-do-well, those don't matter in the context of this commitment between the couple and God. What truly matters is Christ, the commitment to the spouse, and the willingness to learn from past mistakes. The author validates this entire journey with his own experience, offering this profound reassurance. Victory is possible, it has been done, and love is being held alive and waiting out for her right now.
And that conviction, you know, rooted in resilience and faith, it really feels like the only way presented to successfully weather that statistical storm of incarceration. #outro.
Wow. This deep dive into the memoir of A Voice from the Inside, it's provided such a crucial dual perspective, hasn't it? On one hand, the immense, just crushing pressure placed on relationships by the system. And on the other, the specific actionable strategy required for survival and hopefully eventual triumph. We've seen the really sobering statistics that 80% failure rate is hard to forget.
Yeah.
But also the power of intentional communication, essential self-care, and building that foundation on unwavering faith.
Absolutely. The raw honesty contained in this memoir is just invaluable for anyone walking this incredibly difficult path. Today's insight comes to us from a voice from the inside, an individual who recently walked the difficult path of incarceration in Reunion. They offer an unvarnished, firsthand account of the soul-stretching pain and practical hardships, from the strict, Spartan nature of a prison relationship to the deep emotional toll it takes on a loving couple. This perspective is raw, honest, and comes directly from someone who has overcome the challenges of time and distance. Thank you for sharing your powerful testimony with us.
We definitely want to thank CA Jail Outreach for hosting this deep dive and for their unwavering dedication to sharing hope and truth through these powerful narratives. We encourage you, the listener, to explore their work and maybe some of the resources mentioned today using the link provided in the description. A Voice from the Inside did a truly great job with this memoir. We'd like to express our sincere gratitude for providing it.
It really does serve as a true guide for endurance, a testament to hope.
Until the trumpet blows, wishing you a fantastic day.
We just want to take a moment to say a profound and sincere thank you. Your support, your time, and your engagement mean the world to us. We couldn't do this without you. And before we sign off for today, we want to make sure you know the best ways to stay connected. Please make sure you follow us on all of our social media sites. That's where you'll find daily inspiration, updates, and sneak peeks. And of course, look us up on the website for deeper content and resources. All of the links and specific information you need to follow, visit, and connect with us are available right now in the description box of this episode. Finally, we'll leave you with the wisdom of our CEO and founder, David, who always reminds us. Helping is ordinary. Adding ice makes it extraordinary. Thank you again for joining us. We look forward to connecting with you again soon.